From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Robert Siegel. California State University is in trouble. It's the country's largest four-year public university system. And today, the Cal State Faculty Union voted overwhelmingly to authorize a strike over working conditions and pay. Also today, students began a hunger strike, demanding a tuition freeze. As NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports, this crisis is the result of massive state funding cuts.
Cal State University has 23 campuses and over 420,000 students. It's one of three public institutions of higher education in the state. The University of California system and community colleges are the other two. But in the last 10 years, Jared Lovell says CSU has hit a wall. Lovell teaches criminal justice at Cal State Fullerton.
And in the 10 years that I've been here, I've received a 3% raise. I can't afford a home. I could barely afford to rent.
After taking a 10% cut in pay in 2010 and agreeing to an 18-day furlough, Lovell and his union, the California Faculty Association, are asking for a 1% salary increase this year. But it's not just about the money, says Lovell.
Classes are getting cut. Workload is increasing. Class sizes are increasing. And that results in a poorer quality of education. And yes, some of that has to do with morale.
For 22 months, the California Faculty Association and CSU administration have been at an impasse over new terms for evaluating full and part-time faculty, and at least $214 million in salary increases over 3 years. Impossible, says John Swarbrick, CSU's lead negotiator.
Our question back to them at the table is, where does this money come from? Not only for this fiscal year, but for each fiscal year going forward.
Union leaders say from the same place CSU took money to give campus presidents a salary increase at the same time they were raising tuition. Two presidents got a 10% increase just this past March, an increase that CSU spokeswoman Claudia Keith defends.
None of our presidents have gotten an increase since 2007. They all took furloughs, just like all of our employees. So we've all had to sacrifice. Faculty are not alone in that. Our students have had to sacrifice. They're paying more and probably getting less.
CSU's budget crisis, of course, is the result of the state's own budget crisis. Lawmakers slashed $750 million from the California State University budget this school year, triggering layoffs, caps on enrollment, and a 9% increase in tuition. And the state isn't done cutting. In the next few months, it's likely to cut another $200 million.
It's a scary future because you don't know what's going to happen. I mean, if this system crumbles, it's going to become only the rich can go to school.
Sean Axelrod, 22, is a criminal justice major at Cal State Fullerton. He's graduating this month, but like thousands of seniors, he almost didn't because he had such a hard time this semester getting into a course required for graduation.
When I tried to register for it, I was shocked that I was put a number two on the wait list. How can you justify paying all the money if I can't even get the fundamental classes they tell me I need to graduate from here? I would make the argument that you're not getting your money's worth for your education.
Cal State University officials say campuses have had no choice but to ration courses, eliminate programs, and even turn away eligible students. Again, Claudia Keith with the chancellor's office.
We've turned down 25,000 students last year, couldn't get into the California State University because we did not have a spot for them. That is what the public should be in an uproar about, not that we are being, quote, unfair in terms of our collective bargaining agreements.
Faculty members get angry, too, when they hear that their demands are unfair.
Okay, can I have your last name?
Nakaoka. N.A.
Oh. N.A. Okay.
You met.
At Cal State Dominguez Hills, several full and part-time professors have set up a table near the entrance to the library. They say they have no job security, and they're working harder for less money every year. That's why they're striking. Claire Weber, a union member and chair of the sociology department, says the shoddy treatment of faculty ultimately hurts students.
This is their one step into, you know, decent jobs and a middle-class lifestyle, and they're being denied that.
For students, as one professor put it, what was once the gold standard of higher education in this country has turned into fool's gold. It sure feels that way, says Jessica Sharp, 24, a chemistry major.
There is a kind of a gloomy mood, and you kind of start getting off topic in classes when you're talking about this stuff. I feel like our education is being wasted.
Sharp says nobody is blameless here, not lawmakers, not taxpayers, not faculty or administrators. Still, tomorrow, both sides will meet yet again face to face to see what, if anything, they can agree on. Claudio Sanchez, NPR News.
A new book begins with a story you may think you already know. The oil tanker Exxon Valdez ran aground in 1989, covering Alaska's Prince William Sound in oil.
For the writer Steve Cole, that disaster opens a window on something still unfamiliar, the culture of the secretive oil company known today as ExxonMobil. Its executives believed in 1989 they were the industry's best.
I think they did believe that their systems were more idiot-proof than it turned out that they were. And in fact, they had done quite a lot of cost-cutting in the decade leading up to that accident, and I'm not sure that they had reckoned with the consequences of that cutting to their safety systems. But in any event, they were shocked into recognition that their systems were grossly inadequate.
Cole's book, Private Empire, traces the way that Exxon has adapted to that shock.
He examines the recent history of a company that drills for oil around the world, yet has reason to be insecure.
It's incredibly powerful, yet doesn't always get what it wants.
It's a company obsessed with security to the point of paranoia. And after the Exxon Valdez, Cole says executives seem determined never to make any mistake again.
They adopted a whole series of integrated global systems called the Operations Integrity Management System, or OIMS. If you work at Exxon, OIMS is in your brain. It's a series of huge binders with rules telling you about everything that you should do if you requisition a stapler or if you drive across the plant. You're following this manual. And it was designed essentially to put everybody literally on the same page around the world about every task relevant to ExxonMobil's operations.
I'm sorry, requisitioning a stapler? Was that a safety concern when you're getting into details like that?
Yes. Well, they started these safety confessionals, almost worker groups, where people would stand around and talk about near misses, including near misses away from the office. So if you were mowing the lawn and you mishandled the lawnmower and a rock came out and struck you in the leg, you would confess that to your colleagues. The idea was to reduce accidents to as close to zero as was possible and to do this in a kind of collective culture, almost communist, which is sort of odd to say, considering this is an engine of formidable American capitalism.
That's one analogy that comes to mind. The other, when you say safety confessionals, this is beginning to sound like some kind of religious organization.
Or a 12-step program. There's definitely a 12-step element to the way groups talk to each other about their mistakes. And also, the current chairman and chief executive, Rex Tillerson, is well known as a supporter of the Boy Scouts of America, and he also instituted a kind of merit badge system inside the organization where outstanding performances in safety and other areas would be rewarded with coins of the sort that commanders hand out in the military to their soldiers and officers.
Am I wrong in thinking that this points to something larger about Exxon as you describe it? You suggest that this is a company where they really believe they are the smartest guys around, and it must have been intolerable for them to be in that situation after the Exxon Valdez when it didn't look like they were.
Yeah, I think that's right. And also, it's a very insular and cohesive culture, very distinctive even among large American corporations. I think if you took the top 200 corporations in the United States and then you looked at, the top 40 or 50 positions in each company, you'd find in many cases that those positions were occupied by executives who'd come from competing corporations in the same industry or maybe from another industry. They come in with fresh ideas, a reforming spirit. At ExxonMobil, everybody is there for life. If you're willing to adapt to this very rule-heavy culture, if you're willing to move every 3 or 4 years, and you're willing to basically abide by this very insular system, you will rise and you will enjoy lifelong economic security well into retirement.
Well, this is interesting to think about for a moment because we have this company where people honestly believe that they've got the best systems and that it's the best company that could possibly be. But some of the things you're describing actually suggest to me insecurity, anxiety. They're not sure how good they are. They're not sure what people would find if they were open to full inspection.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And one of the things I tried to understand in the reporting was, let's put ourselves in their shoes. What is it like to run a company that is so unpopular? What do you do about that? Well, they've asked themselves that question. And they look back at American history in search of a golden age of oil industry popularity, and they can't find it. So they're not really sure what model to build. And the fact that no matter what strategy they try, they remain unpopular only reinforces this sort of defensive crouch. And finally, you know, they look out at some of their competitors who have tried to green themselves, like BP, which adopted a logo.
Beyond Petroleum.
Yeah, with a sun and little green trim. And they laugh at that. And they take pride in the fact that they say, look, we're not going to try to fool you into thinking that we're a solar company when, you know, 98% of our revenue comes from oil and gas or chemicals.
What do you think their greatest anxiety is?
I think they have a basic problem of replacing the amount of oil and gas they pump out of the ground every year because of their sheer scale. They pump out 4.5 million barrels of oil and gas every year. That's basically 1.5 billion barrels a year. They've got to go out and find that and bring it online every year. And the world is not friendly to supermajors that want to own oil and gas the way it was back in the 60s and 70s.
Supermajors, that's the handful of really, really large oil companies.
Yeah. And so Saudi Arabia and Iran and Iraq used to be the playground of a company like Exxon, and they never really had to worry about running out of oil because there was so much of it and they owned it in those places. Well, an era of nationalism, resource nationalism, arose in the Middle East in the 1970s and basically locked ExxonMobil out of the easy oil and gas and sent them basically in two directions. One, into weak states in places like Africa, where the host governments just don't have the capacity to own and develop the oil and gas themselves. They need a partner like ExxonMobil. Or into the free market West, where anybody can own anything, but there hasn't been a lot of oil and gas to drill until very recently with these discoveries of unconventional gas. So I mean, the basic problem they face is what they call reserve replacement, that is, finding enough oil and gas to replace that which they pump out and sell every year.
Well, is the world gradually forcing ExxonMobil to change, however much they would prefer not to?
It's bringing them back to the United States in an interesting way. That's one way it's forcing them to change, and it's bringing them to natural gas. That's the big story looking ahead for ExxonMobil. They've made a big bet on natural gas in the United States, fracking, unconventional gas. They bought the biggest producer of such gas in the United States, XTO, in 2010. And when they look out over the next 20 or 30 years, a lot of their strategic plan involves moving to natural gas and moving into the what you would think of in comparison to Chad or Nigeria as the relatively stable political environment of the United States. But as we all know, fracking itself has already become a great controversy. And I think what's interesting is that ExxonMobil's once again going to be challenged to find political adeptness, you know, in the United States on a big environmental controversy around fracking. Do they have the skills to work subtly to achieve their goals, or will they continue to just put their elbows out and charge ahead?
Steve Call is the author of Private Empire, ExxonMobil and American Power. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve.
While California's state budget woes have contributed to the stress on public university kids there, students across the country are feeling the squeeze in other ways. More than 7 million students could face a doubling of their federal loan rates if Congress can't agree on a plan to prevent it. At the same time, students of all backgrounds are coming of age in an era when the economy is always described as recovering, never recovered. So, with graduation coming up, how are they feeling about their prospects?
Gosh, not that good.
This is Caitlin Peterson. She's 23. We found her when we went to the University of Maryland in College Park. She's a grad student there in Library and Information Studies. It's the kind of school where the shuttle buses have perky slogans on the side. They say things like, "Hey, recession, fear the turtle." That's the school's mascot, a diamondback terrapin. But right now, students like Caitlin say the recession has the edge over the turtle.
Considering that we're all graduating with thousands and thousands of dollars of debt already, to go into an economy that's not hiring. A lot of people are moving back in with their parents. A lot of people are working part-time crap jobs.
25-year-old Amanda Mason Singh, same boat.
I have a lot of debt. I think it's over $100,000. So, because I've been to a bachelor's program, a master's program, and now I'm in a PhD program.
And at the end of the day, you look at this economy and think it's going to be better, worse, middling. You know, what are your chances? What are you looking forward to?
I think it's good. I mean, I think I'm still optimistic. Like, I think here...
You're still optimistic. I just want to talk about it. You have $100,000 in debt. You're not sure you'll ever work.
I feel very confident about, like, working. So I know I have an internship next year. So I'm not concerned about finding a job afterwards. I think it's just a matter of thinking of how much debt I do have and how much I will have to work in order to pay that off.
She's hoping she'll find a job with her doctorate in human development. Then there are the pragmatists, just starting out or recalibrating their plans as the economy chugs along.
My name is Akeem Alade. I'm a current sophomore at the University of Maryland, planning to major in civil engineering. I'm from PG County, Maryland. Go Terps.
Akeem Alade started out planning to major in business. Seems like a good idea, right? Not according to Akeem's father.
Before I came to college, he had me like read a couple of articles. I know I read one about this girl who was like top of her class, valedictorian and everything, majored in business, but she couldn't find a job and she was like working as a waitress and she was unemployed for I think about like 3 years after she got out of college.
Akeem didn't think he could argue with that cautionary tale. Meanwhile, 22-year-old Andrew Hanlon, he's placing his bets with a science degree as well, in kinesiology. That's the study of body movement.
With all the baby boomers retiring and everything like that, they need health care, and physical therapists are one of the major providers of
that. So you got a plan. That's a great plan.
Yeah.
Do you get the sense, though, that basically your generation is walking into good, bad, what kind of situation?
I mean, I think we got screwed over pretty good, but we know the environment we're walking into. It's not like we don't know.
It's pretty scary. If you do think about it.
That's Lev Heller. He's 18. And even though it's scary, he's been thinking a lot about his generation.
I think in a way most generations get a raw deal. I think that we think things are really bad at any given point, but the fact is it's not really that they suddenly change for worse. There's a new problem for every generation to deal with, and most of the time we have dealt with it.
Not surprisingly, Lev Heller is a philosophy major, and he has a plan to prepare for this economy, to spend more time in school, in his case, medical school. Finally this hour, a profile of a long jumper who is training for what's probably her last shot at the Olympics. Shamika Marshall is 28 years old. She tried but didn't make the Olympic team in 2004 and 2008. 4 years from now, by track and field standards, she may be too old. Reporter Yo-Wei Shaw checked in with her as she prepares for the Olympic trials next month.
Shamika Marshall is tiny, only 5'2", but she flies through the air and lands heels and butt in the sand.
Kevin!
She also coaches track and field at Temple University in Philadelphia.
You're done your two laps already?
But before Marshall or her students can practice the long jump, they need to clean the sand pit. Today was Dylan Pencil's turn.
We found kids' toys mainly and like sand toys, but today we found a hammer, an actual like put a nail in wood hammer.
That's one of the pitfalls of training at a public field. People just come up to Marshall and hit on her or ask questions.
Some of them just kind of say, yeah, track star, you're a track star. Like when I start a conversation and I'm training and I'm like, now is not the time. You know, I got 2 hours set to do what I need to do and I have to get out of here. So
she has to block out distractions. She wasn't always so focused on track and field. In high school, she used to hate it.
And it was like, ugh, I don't want to run. I hate this. You know, I hate the anxiety. I hate being in track, even though I'm good at it.
Marshall was about to turn down 3 college sports scholarships when her mom told her to pray about it.
So I did, and my prayer was like, Lord, you know I hate track. And like before I could get all of that out of my mouth, it was like, this is a gift. Just that's what I heard inside of me. This is a gift. And I was like, oh, I can't just throw that away.
Marshall makes running and jumping look easy. For the Olympics, she's also training for the hurdles. But the long jump has always been her number one event.
I can go down the runway, stop midway if I wanted to, and come back because I have a whole minute to do what I wanted to do. So that was a relaxing situation for me, as opposed to the hurdles where when the gun goes off, you have to run. And, you know, you can't wait and say, wait, I'm not ready.
Marshall says the secret to a good long jump is all in the setup. As she runs to the launching board, Marshall listens to her footsteps to make sure she has the right rhythm. It starts off slowly, but still with power.
Then I move into an area where it's getting sharper and it's getting faster. And then I get into the last part of my rhythm that's quick, it's precise, it's clean. It's like a clap, like, and then you're in the air, just floating.
This year, Marshall hopes to jump past 23 feet and to make it to the Olympics, of course. She says if it doesn't happen, she probably won't try again. No matter how it turns out, when the track season is over, Marshall will start focusing on her true passion, music. It's what she went to college for.
My body's not going to be able to do this forever, as far as track and field goes. But I'll be able to sing for many years.
Keeping you first with my all, shining the light you put in us, living as you called us to be. Follow you.
Marshall is almost ready to start recording the dozens of songs she's written. But first, she has to see just how far she can go with this other gift she was given. She'll find out at the Olympic Trials at Hayward Field, Eugene, Oregon, June 29th. For NPR News, I'm Yowei Shaw.
Even though it's been a long day, even though it's been a fun one, even though it's been a busy one, I can say you're with me.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Coming up, I'll share some of my thoughts on the fifth anniversary of Tell Me More in my weekly essay. But first, we were talking earlier about the president's quick trip to Afghanistan. In his remarks to the troops serving there, he made sure to talk about the cost of the war on those fighting it. It was a reminder that service members who spent time in Afghanistan and Iraq might be able to leave those countries behind when they finish their tours, but some memories follow. As well, some of the conflicts they left at home meet them at the door. Those situations are at the heart of Water by the Spoonful. The play won this year's Pulitzer Prize for Drama. It focuses on Elliot, who's still adjusting to life back in Philadelphia after serving in Iraq. In this scene, Elliot is working, trying to take a carryout order over the phone when he's confronted by a vision of an Iraqi man he encountered during his time in the war. Here's a clip.
That's three teriyaki onion with chicken. First with hots and onions, second with everything. Third with extra bacon. Some spicy Italian with American cheese on whole grain. One BMT on flatbread. Good so far?
Mumkin mit potluck. Pidini chawa supper.
Five chocolate chip cookies. 12-meal raisin. Three baked lays, three Doritos, two Sprite Zeros, one box. One Coke. And two orange sodas. How'd I do?
Mumkin mit potluck. Pidini chawa supper.
Yeah, that'll be ready in 15 minutes.
That was a clip from Water by the Spoonful, staged at the Hartford Stage Theater in Connecticut last fall. And the playwright, newly crowned as this year's Pulitzer Prize winner for drama, is Chiara Alegria Hudes. And she joins us now from our bureau in New York. Congratulations and welcome to the program. Thanks
so
much.
Thank you so much. I'm very excited.
You know, I have to ask you where you were and what you were doing when you found out.
Well, I had no notion of the fact that anything called a Pulitzer was being announced. I just dropped my daughter off at pre-kindergarten and drove a few hours north on the Merritt Parkway to Wesleyan and turned off my phone and went into class where I teach playwriting to undergraduates. We were taking a break and stretching our legs a few hours into class, and I turned on my phone and I was the last to know. There were a lot of messages and my phone was just beeping, doing things it never does. And so it really was a complete surprise. So I was the last to know, and then I guess my class was came after me because I told them, and they were very happy. And
were you scared? To be honest, were you scared at first that something bad had happened? I mean, generally, when you turn your phone off and there's a whole bunch of messages, you know, on it, you're like,
Yeah, I think they were very scared because they started hearing the beeps, and they said the blood drained from my face.
No,
and you know, it's funny not to get morbid all of a sudden, but on a flight to actually in a first preview down to Atlanta, Georgia, some years back at the Alliance Theater, I had a similar experience where I turned on my phone and there were seven or eight messages and I just knew. And that was a dear aunt of mine who's one of the inspirations for this play. Her name is Eugenia Burgos, and she had passed. And so I had to stay in the airport and get right back on a plane. Mm-hmm. This time when when the messages passed the 20 mark, 25 mark, I thought, okay, this is good news. Not that many people will call me if something bad had happened.
Well, that's a good attitude to have. Well, that's a good way for me to ask you, what was the inspiration for this play? And I do want to mention it's the second in what I understand is a trilogy. And at the center of all of these plays is the character of Elliot, who is an Iraq War veteran. Can you just tell us a little bit about him?
The veteran comes right out of a family story. In fact, one of the experiences I had in North Philly was that right around when the war started, the violence that I witnessed the most in some ways was overseas, because a lot of our young men and women in the community were enlisting to go fight in Iraq, to get paid well. Some of them didn't have a strong set of college prospects, and this was a very well-respected thing they could do with their early adulthood. You know, it's funny, we can really forget about wars and these sorts of conflicts pretty quickly, and it's not a very exciting topic these days anymore, because there are not easy ways to have those conversations in commonplace civilian life about how do you live with that? What happened there? Who does that make you now?
Water by the Spoonful features a very diverse cast. There are white, African-American, Asian-American, Latino characters. Yeah, was that kind of, forgive me for using the language, embedded into the idea? Or is that just something that happened as you started casting it?
No, it was part of the original idea, I think, and something really clicked in while I was writing this. In the play Elliot, A Soldier's Fugue, it deals with one Puerto Rican family in North Philadelphia, and all of the characters are Latino. And in this play, I stick with that family, but one of the family members runs this chat room, and I realized as I did my research that one of the reasons why people were logging on to such websites was because there was a level of anonymity, and so people from various communities who for various reasons maybe didn't have the comfort level or the access to Narcotics Anonymous meetings could log on. I created a character, an African-American man who is a paper pusher at the IRS in California. I created a young Japanese woman who was raised in the United States who returns to Japan in search of her birth parents. And I created an affluent white man, and they all find connection in this chat room.
Yeah, I was going to ask, is this that world, this with, you know, connecting with all kinds of people, I can see now as a successful artist and playwright and writer that would be your world now. But was that your world growing up, or was that something that you had envisioned? I think you grew up in Philadelphia, right?
I grew up in Philadelphia, mm-hmm. And I had the most international world at my fingertips. It's hard to describe my childhood. You have to know the map of Philly pretty well. But basically, I was born and raised in West Philly, which is a combination of a lot of hippies. My parents frequented a commune there. And also on our block, there's a lot of old Victorian homes that had kind of fallen into disrepair. So they were large and they were inexpensive. And so my block was a starter home for a lot of large immigrant families. So just across the street, my best friend Chin was Vietnamese. And he told me these stories about boat people in Vietnam. His family had escaped Vietnam in a boat. Right next door to him was Rowitha. She was Ethiopian. Her family had just moved from Ethiopia. I myself was... I'm half Jewish and half Puerto Rican. We were the only Latino family on the block. And so in some ways growing up, I felt most at home in places where there was not one default identity, but it was just a lot of people thrown together telling stories and being amazed at each other's various backgrounds.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're speaking with the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Kiara Alegría Hudes. She won for her play Water by the Spoonful. You wrote for another acclaimed production, the Tony Award-winning musical In the Heights. I think you collaborated with Lin-Manuel Miranda on that play, which was set in the Washington Heights neighborhood. And, you know, that play was also heralded for bringing stories, you know, about Latinos, especially, you know, Dominicans and Puerto Ricans of the neighborhood to a stage. I remember I talked to him about that, and I had the opportunity to interview him. And I asked him, you know, there were people saying, well, you know, it's not really real because nobody gets stabbed or whatever. And I just asked him, well, how do you feel about just how people are responding to your...
In my experience, some of the criticism that we faced about that it was a We were kind of painting the community with rose-colored glasses, and we weren't dealing with the violence. Those criticisms tended not to come from people who were living inside those communities. And in fact, at a certain point, we looked up the crime statistics. We said, okay, let's deal with this head on. You know, what are people talking about? And we found out that in the neighborhood that we were writing in for the year we were writing in, it had a lower crime rate than other areas in Manhattan. So, you know, I think people do bring a lot of weight and baggage to Latino stories, but really sometimes those sorts of criticisms can be louder than they are in terms of quantity. And we did find that the community was mostly quite grateful for a different way of portraying it.
In your play, though, the reviews have been very wonderful. I think people have described it as funny, wise, and touching. I know in Variety described it that way. That must be very gratifying.
It's very gratifying. When I started writing the first play in the trilogy, Elliot, A Soldier's View, I was very nervous. I wanted to deal with the war, but I wanted to deal with it through a lens of joy. And that was wonderful, and it opened up a different angle on war to me. Then, for part two, I thought, oh boy, I want to deal with addiction. How am I going to do that? I was very nervous about it because I think it's a pretty miserable and painful topic. And once I realized that I was going to deal with it through the lens of recovery, that really opened up a world to me, because we're all recovering from life. And when I started doing research and visiting NA meetings, visiting AA meetings, checking out these chat rooms online, interviewing counselors and recovering addicts, what I found is there is a lingo amongst recovering communities that is hilarious. And they have just a really wicked, sharp sense of self-deprecating humor. And I thought, this is it. This is it. I can make people laugh in this play. This play doesn't have to wallow in misery. It can be about laughing at ourselves, even in our darkest moments.
I understand. Okay, of course, I read this in the New York Times. Okay, I'm not going to pretend like I just knew this. None of the Pulitzer jurors actually saw the play. Mm-hmm. They made the decision just based on the script. Mm-hmm. Now, as a writer, how does that feel? Does that feel good or does that feel bad?
It feels really good. I mean, I feel that one of the wonderful things about being a playwright, one of the parts of this life that I love, is that our work exists fully realized in two realms, which is on the page and on the stage. You know, growing up, I read Shakespeare. I read O'Neill. I read August Wilson. I read scripts that I didn't have access to. I understood them as literature, and they spoke to me very directly. And then as a teenager and as a young adult, I started going to see more plays, and that had a whole different impact on me. And so I do feel that plays can outlive us all, because they do stay on the page and they speak to future generations. And so it means a lot to me that my work was read as such, as literature, as work on a page. And I hope that the next translation to stage is as impactful as I thought the original staging was at Hartford Stage Company.
Is there a plan to have it staged again so that others can see it? As I understand that the play ran for about a month last fall in Hartford, Connecticut. Any plans to have another staging so that other people can experience it?
Oh, absolutely. Right now we're in the process of figuring out how to bring it to New York as swiftly and with as exciting a production as possible. I don't know more than that, but I feel that it will happen soon, and also to publish soon so that people can read the play.
Chiara Alegría Hudes is the winner of this year's Pulitzer Prize for Drama. Her play is called Water by the Spoonful, and she was kind enough to join us from our bureau in New York. Chiara, thank you so much for joining us, and every good wish for you.
Thank you.